We're in chapter 12. We're going to start at verse 4 tonight. But verse 3 in chapter 12 really sort of sets the stage for everything that we're going to be discussing. And I like the way that the New International Translation puts Hebrews 12:3. He said, "He," and that's of course Jesus put up with attacks from sinners. So think about him. Then you won't get tired. You won't lose hope. And then in here in chapter 12 at verse 4, he begins to talk about some things that can threaten our faithfulness. They're not things that, as I understand Hebrews 12, I don't think they're things that God does, but it's the fact that we live in an evil, broken world, and we're going to encounter some things that make it difficult. Now, we'll talk about that a little bit more as we go on, but the first thing that he talks about is in verse 4. He says, "In your struggle against sin, you've not yet resisted to the point of shedding your blood." And I like the way the New International Version puts it. You struggle against sin. Just like Jesus struggled against sin, you struggle against sin. And of course, Jesus told his disciples, his apostles, the world didn't understand me, they're not going to understand you. So expect that there's going to be a struggle with the world. But he says, you've not yet fought to the point of shedding your own blood. The American Standard says, you've not yet resisted to the shedding of your own blood. And I think it's important for us to understand that this peril, this assault on our faith is going to come. It's going to come to us too. And I think when he says, you have not yet resisted to the point of shedding your own blood, I think he's making a prediction that this is, I know it was happening at the time that Hebrews was written, but I think he's making a prediction that even if you're not at that point yet, you will be at that point. And I think we as Christians have to understand that we are going to see Christians resisting to the point of shedding their blood. You know, the United States is not the whole world. I get a magazine called The Voice of the Martyrs, and there are countless stories in that magazine, and you can find them on the internet as well, of Christians in some places who are being killed because of their faith. You know, like I say, it's not here yet, but from my reading of what the writer says here in Hebrews, Christians just have to expect it. It's going to come. It may not be us personally, it may be somebody else, but the reality is that at no point in time, even as bad as it got during the first century or the second century, there was never a time when all of the Christians were put to death. And the fact is, you don't have to put every one of the Christians to death to achieve the effect of chilling their faith. In fact, maybe you gain something, if you want to look at it that way, by not killing them all. So it may not be us personally, but we do have to say that yes, we know that this is happening. I know people who have been in peril of their lives. I don't know anyone who personally who has died, but I have talked to Christians who had to flee for their life, much like the early Christians did, have to flee Jerusalem. And even Aquila and Priscilla had to flee Jerusalem along with a lot of other Christians. And it indicates that the only ones that were left in Jerusalem were the apostles. Many are at that point already in other places. I hope that we don't get to that point during my lifetime. But I expect that the persecution of Christians is going to become worse and worse. And I expect that we will shed our blood. That'll be difficult for Christians to face. Now here's what he says following that. And he says, don't forget that the Lord always encourages you when you are disciplined. And so it's going to take a little bit to develop this idea. But in verse 5, he says, have you completely forgotten this word of encouragement that addresses you as a father addresses his son? It says, my son, do not make light of the Lord's discipline, and do not lose heart when he rebukes you, because the Lord disciplines the one he loves, and he chastens everyone he accepts as sons. So there's, I think, some real encouragement here. He says, don't make light of the hardship. So don't treat this lightly, whether it's your hardship or the hardship that someone else is facing. Don't make light of it. It is hard. But don't lose heart in believing that the Lord has deserted you when he allows you to face discipline through hardship. And I try to understand this. He says, don't make light of the Lord's discipline. Don't lose heart when he rebukes you, because the Lord disciplines the one he loves, and he chastens everyone he accepts as his son. In the New International Translation, verse 6 says, well, let's read verse 5 as well. It says, you've forgotten the word of hope. It speaks to you as children. It says, my son, think of the Lord's training as important. Don't lose hope when he corrects you. The Lord trains those he loves. He punishes everyone he accepts as a son. So don't think that God has deserted you when he allows you to face discipline. Now, he goes on and he says, endure hardship as discipline. New International says, put up with hard times. God uses them to train you. And that's the root meaning of the word discipline, is training that's suitable to a learner. He says, God is treating you as his children. What children are not disciplined by their father? If you're not disciplined, and everyone undergoes discipline, then you're not legitimate. You're not true sons and daughters at all. So rather than thinking that God has deserted you when you face hardship, understand that you're facing that hardship because God treats you like a son. desertion by God would be no training, no discipline. Only the illegitimate are deserted. God's children would never be deserted. Comments at this point. Okay. Now he introduces this idea that helps me to understand what's going on. He says, moreover, we've all had human fathers who disciplined us and we respected them for it. How much more should we submit to the Father of spirits and live? They disciplined us for a little while as they thought best, but God disciplines us for our good in order that we may share in his holiness. Now, when a father trains his children, an earthly father, he does the best we can, best that he can. But we know that our earthly fathers make mistakes. Our parents trained us for a little while. It says in the New International Version, they did what they thought was best. But every one of us who's a parent, and it doesn't matter whether you're mother or father, have you made mistakes in the training of your children? What? I think every one of us would have to say, yes, we make mistakes. God is not like that in that he makes mistakes. But he is like our Father in that he does some things so that we can learn from them. Or he lets us go into some places that we would not go, or that he could prevent us from going to. And let me explain that a little bit. When a child wants to go to a certain place, his parents look at it and they say, I really don't want you to go there. They're going to make fun of you if you go. They're going to ridicule your faith. They're going to do everything that they can to put you down. Our fathers, our parents, sometimes let us go to that place. Now, that doesn't mean that our parent is the source of the hardship. The source of the hardship is coming from evil people. It's coming from those people that don't know God. It's real easy to mistake God allowing us to face hardship for God causing hardship. I've gone back and I've looked at what Paul said about his thorn in the flesh. He doesn't say that God gave him that thorn in the flesh. It says that he was given a thorn in the flesh. And God allowed it to happen. That's because God, just like our earthly parents, says you're going to have to go into these places. You're going to have to learn to stand up for yourself. And the only way you can do that is by going in there and facing this hardship. So God always disciplines or trains for our good. If God was to say, if my parents were to say, Dean, I'm not going to let you go to that place. I'm not going to let you go to that party. I'm not going to let you go to that school. Because if you go to that school, I know what's going to happen. And they're right. They can reasonably foresee that I'm going to have a very difficult time at that school or at that party, and they want to protect me from that. But if they only protect me from that, then I wind up being a 35-year-old who's never had to defend his faith. And that's not good. I haven't gone through the learning process that I could have gone through if my father really loved me. And he did. He let me do things knowing that I was going to have a hard time. Comments. Does that make sense to anyone? This is how I square the idea that God does not tempt man. That's what John says. God does not tempt man, but evil people tempt us. Evil people cause hardship. God never asks us to do something that's not good for us.
Isn't that what they said, that they meant evil for you, but God made it into good? So whatever happens, God will make it for your good, even if it's something that was horrible. He can make it for you. He can make it better.
I think that's a part of it, Carol.
Well, I agree with you, because God always knows best what's for us, and our parents tend to try to protect us so it won't happen. But ultimately, how are you going to learn unless you do it yourself? You have to learn how to defend your faith. So,
yeah. As a parent, it's really scary to say to your child, yeah, it's okay. You can go, you can do this. And I think about a lot of people who are choosing to homeschool their children. And I understand why they're homeschooling their children, because they want to keep them from having to face some of the things that they would have to face in the public school system. And, you know, I applaud that decision. I am not in the position of having to deal with whether I would homeschool my children or let them go to public schools right now. And frankly, the public school system is really scary. I can see a lot of reasons for people choosing to homeschool their children.
Well, I agree with that too, because it's scary just for me to hear what they're teaching, and it's to first and second graders, and it's ridiculous. It's horrible, actually. So if I were able to, I would homeschool them.
And I understand the reasoning behind people wanting to homeschool their children. I can also see the other side of it, saying, as a parent, I want to give them this training. It's not that I'm causing the hardship. I know that they're going to face it, and I'm going to let them face it because that's what it takes for them to be trained. Other thoughts? You know, I don't mean to pick on the public school system. That's just a part of it. When I was at home and my dad was raising me, I wanted to be in Boy Scouts. And my dad wouldn't let me be in Boy Scouts because Boy Scouts. I was in Cub Scouts, but he said, you can't continue to be in Boy Scouts because they go on overnight camping trips. And they always go Saturday night and Sunday. And I'm not going to put you into the position of saying, I can't go because I need to go to church on Sunday. I need to go to the assembly on Sunday. So he didn't want to put me in that awkward position. I respect him for doing that. I think I made different decisions with our girls, but I do understand why he made the decision that he made. And I know how bad we would feel if we allowed our child to go into that hardship situation and our child was defeated. That would be crushing. Kirsten, you looked like you wanted to make a comment.
Oh, I was just, I had a hard time with the word discipline because I think of it as like, you know, being mean. But I didn't like the word training and I didn't like the word routine. So I found that it could also mean direction and bringing into line. Behaving was another kind of one that where I went for, because I feel like these are all, to me, better words to use with God. Because they're happier and not so sad. You know, being honest, motivated, and encouraged while doing a task. You know, your task at hand is to, you know, stay focused on God and what He wants you to do. So that's kind of where I was going with all of the reading when I was doing the reading. And found a couple of verses that I kind of like. Proverbs 12:1. I liked it because it said, whosoever loves discipline loves knowledge, but he who hates reproof is stupid. And I got a kick out of the word stupid because it was God used the word stupid. And I just found that kind of funny, but it is. It's, you know, it that word fit it perfectly. So, I don't know. That's just where I went with this whole lesson for tonight. But I think they need to teach more of this in school and not avoid it. But that's a whole nother topic. So,
yeah. And for people who, I mean, both of my daughters teach in public schools. So I know what a hard place that can be. And, when I have been able to talk to people who were going to college, and they were, you know, in the process of deciding what their major was going to be, even though my major was political science, the first time I went to college and the second time I went to college, it was psychology. I tell people, especially young people, Stay away from psychology, because you're going to hear a lot and you will be ridiculed a lot by professors, by peers. And maybe that's a bad thing. Maybe I'm not preparing them, you know, but I know what that's like. I mean, I went back to school as a psychology major when I was 50. And when you're 50 years old, it's a little bit easier to look at your professor and say, you know, that just doesn't make any sense. That's just a bunch of hogwash. But that's hard when you're 19 or 20. And you're a freshman in college, and nobody agrees with you.
I guess what I was getting at, even in the lower grades, they say, well, you can be a boy if you want to, or you can be a girl. And then they change all the rules for the whole people that are going to school. And it starts at an early, early age. It's just, I don't know. It's harder now, I think, than it was for us. I'm sure it is, because we knew the truth in the first place, and a lot of people don't. And they just, you know, but even when you're well grounded, it's difficult.
That's why he has to talk about these perils that you're going to face.
I don't know, but they do it at an early, early age. So.
Oh, sure. I mean, I read a story the other day about a child in, I think it was first grade, who was suspended from school because he misgendered a transgender person. He called a girl a girl, and she wanted to be called a boy. And he, knowing first graders, he probably laughed and said, "That's stupid. You're a girl," but nevertheless, because he refused to call her by her preferred pronoun or address her as the gender that she wanted to be addressed as, he was suspended from school.
Dean?
Yeah.
I think that the negative that discipline gets is, you just wait. When I get you home, I'm going to discipline you, or your father's going to discipline you, or whatever. But if you think about a magician, unless he disciplines himself to be able to do the sleight of hand, he is never going to be able to be a magician. So the discipline is applying the knowledge into your life and into your practice.
Right. And I understand where Kirsten is coming from, because discipline does have such a negative connotation in our society. And I think we've even allowed it to have a negative connotation in the church as well. We talk about church discipline as being what happens when the church withdraws from someone. And that's not really what church discipline is. Church discipline is how we help each other to be what God expects us to be. It's making disciples out of people. And that, you know, I understand that starts at baptism, but remember when Jesus talked to his apostles, right before he died, right after he died, he said, go into all the world, make disciples of every creature, baptizing them in the name of the Father, the Son, and the Spirit, and teaching them to observe all things whatsoever I've commanded you. So this make disciples is a two-step process. You get them started, and then you keep them going. Somebody was trying to comment. I talked over you. I'm sorry.
No, you cut out. I couldn't hear everything you were saying. I just thinking, Kirsten's just remembering when she was young and the word discipline, that's what she's remembering.
Oh, yeah.
I was just kidding.
It's true. The thing is, when we see the word discipline, we think that means spank. My parents did. spare the rod and spoil the child. That's the proverb. Well, we think that's discipline. It's not the extent of discipline. You know, positive reinforcement is discipline. Saying to your child, "You did a good job with that," is discipline. It's training our children.
Dean?
Yes.
When I was looking, I did have the help of Google when I was looking up discipline. So I can't take credit for the thoughts, but definitely not, because one of them was they had discipline according to the Bible. And one of the verses was Titus 1:8. But it starts in 7 because it says, "For the overseer must be above reproach as God's steward, not self-willed, not quick-tempered, not addicted to wine, not pugnacious, not fond of sordid gain, but hospitable, loving, what is good, sensible, just, devout, and self-controlled." And I felt like those also take discipline. And so I was like, oh, that's a good verse to be disciplined in a happy way.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. And that's a good way to look at it. I think we just have to... we have to remember that God disciplines by allowing us to go into hard places so that we can learn how to be faithful. And you're not going to learn that unless you go into those hard places.
Right, but he's not going to give you a task that's too hard for you. But, I mean, he'll challenge you, but he knows exactly what you need when you need it at the right time.
That's the encouragement in all this. God won't allow us to be tempted above what we are able. But God's picture of what we're able to do maybe bigger than our picture of what we're able to do.
Dean?
Yeah.
I think in a way we're still talking about discipline, sort of about the negative things, but he disciplines us to be patient and kind and to be generous and to pay attention to other people. So there are a lot of positive things that we don't do all on our own, to love your brother as yourself. And he disciplines us to help us to get to that point. So it's not just the taking out of our lives, but it's the adding to our lives too.
That's true. Good point. And I don't know if you've watched the PBS special on Band of Brothers, but those guys that had to fight together in a hellish situation learned a certain kindness for their fellow man that I'm not sure they could have learned anywhere else. So they learned positive things. I would never say that I want to go into a war because I want to learn all of the good things that can come from being in a war, but that may be why God lets us do that. Not that God causes the war, but he does arrange for us to be disciplined. And he allows us to go into hard places so that we can learn. Any other comments? I'll tell you, I'm glad that I'm not raising kids. This world is a scary place. And no doubt my parents thought the world was a scary place when they were raising me. And I thought it was a scary place when I was raising a girl. But I don't know. It just seems like the world is getting worse and worse. The evil is getting greater. Okay, let's go on. In verse 11, he says, no discipline seems pleasant at the time, but painful. And that may be why we think that discipline means spank or punish. No discipline seems pleasant at the time, but painful. Later on, however, it produces a harvest of righteousness and peace for those who have been trained by it. So no training experience is pleasant. It's not pleasant for an athlete who's training to run a marathon. It's not pleasant for a swimmer who's learning to swim the English Channel. But if you want to learn how to do that, you have to go through the pain.
Pain?
Yeah.
His example of to the thief, to it's not just you're not just a thief anymore, but that you're supposed to get a job and then you're supposed to have money so that you can give it away. You don't think about that being painful. But to the thief who didn't want to spend his own money and he was willing to take somebody else's, it is, in a way, it's painful. And so that's why the training comes into something like that, that's going from a negative to a positive. It doesn't seem to make sense, but it does.
Yeah, that's true. That's a good point. You know, I used to quote that scripture, let him that stole steal no more, but rather let him labor working with his hands that he may have to give to him that lacks. I used to say, let him that stole steal no more working with his hands. So you just got to get the commas in the right place. No discipline at the time seems pleasant, but painful. And I think that may be what contributes to the notion that discipline has to be painful. You know, I am a behaviorist in terms of psychology. I'm a behaviorist. And one of the things that I learned as a behaviorist, just thinking about what happens in life, you know, mom and dad come home from work, they're tired, and mom has to get the dinner on the table, and dad has to take care of getting out the garbage and cutting the grass, and what you want most of all is for the kids to play quietly while you take care of the job that you have to do. And so when the kids play quietly, we ignore them. We go about doing the job that we have to do. Mom is in the kitchen cooking dinner. Dad is in the yard cutting the grass. It's only when they do something that we didn't want them to do that we pay attention to them. And they would rather be scolded than to be ignored. Because at least if we're scolding them, we're paying some attention to them. And that's what they want. They desperately want attention from their parents. And so it's hard to train in a positive way. It's when the child is calmly playing on the floor with his blocks that dad needs to sit down on the floor with the child and play with the blocks with the child. That's what the child craves, is the attention from the parent. But when they're playing calmly with their blocks, we think, oh, this is my chance to go get the yard mowed. But training is sometimes painful. In that case, training is very rewarding for the child who is being trained. Training is very rewarding for the child. And it will produce the harvest of righteousness. Okay, let's go on. So he says, therefore, because of all the things that I've said, strengthen your feeble arms and weak knees. Make level paths for your feet so that the lame may not be disabled, but rather healed. And now he talks about the proper way to live. So he's warned us about some things that we have to deal with that are a part of training that are not particularly always pleasant. And now he gives us the proper way to live. So he says, make every effort to live at peace with everyone. That's number one. This is what you need to be trained to do. Make every effort to live at peace with everyone. Another writer said, as much as lies within you, be at peace. I can't be at peace with people that hate me. No matter what I do, I am not going to be at peace with them. And I think about that when I think about the Israel-Hamas conflict. No matter what Israel does, Hamas is not going to be at peace with them. And it also needs to be said, no matter what Hamas does, Israel is not going to be at peace with them. Although I think the odds are better for Israel responding by living peacefully. But there are some people that will hate you. You know, we have the meme that says haters gonna hate. And nothing you can do is gonna change that. But he says, make every effort to live at peace with everyone. That's my job, to try to live at peace. And I just, as an aside, I read an interesting article just the other day. Someone was saying, you know, if I come in late to church, if I get to the assembly late, everybody turns around and frowns and they scowl at me like, why couldn't you get here on time? He said, if I'm an alcoholic and I come into my AA meeting late, they stop and they applaud because they know that in a moment of weakness, I might have given up, but I didn't. I stayed with it. And I came to the meeting. It took me, you know, I struggled with whether I was going to go to this meeting or not, but I made it. I did go, even if I got there for the last 10 minutes. So in as much as lies within us, we need to be at peace with everyone. So I think if somebody, and we're coming up on a time when sometimes folks come to an assembly of Christians once a year or twice a year, Easter and Christmas, and don't denigrate them because they only came once. Prop them up for coming once. And we'll move on from there, but there's something to be said for that. Make every effort to live at peace with everyone. Then I supplied the second part of that verse. It says, make every effort to live in peace with everyone. That's verse 14. The second part of the verse is to be holy. So I supplied the words, make every effort to be holy. Without holiness, no one will see the Lord. So make every effort to be at peace with everyone and to be holy, to live a holy life. Now he'll go on and he says, see to it that no one falls short of the grace of God, that no bitter root grows up to cause trouble and defile many. It's easy to be bitter when we find ourselves faced with hardship, and especially when people are attacking us. And I think the point of this may be, God put us in that place where they would attack us, or he let us go there. God didn't attack us. The evil people attacked us. And he says, you got to learn not to be bitter. Because bitterness will get in the way of being at peace with everyone. It just causes trouble and defiles. So live as a person who respects the tremendous blessing that you have in the grace of God. And then verse 16 and 17. Avoid sexual impurity. He says, see that no one is sexually immoral or is godless like Esau, who for a single meal sold his birthrights or sold his inheritance rights as the oldest son. Afterward, as you know, when he wanted to inherit this blessing, he was rejected. Even though he sought the blessing with tears, he could not change what he had done. And I wondered why not being able to change a bad decision that you made is associated with sexual immorality. Because it's he says, don't see that no one is sexually immoral or godless like Esau. So this, what Esau did is attached to sexually immoral and godless. Any thoughts?
I don't know, that reads kind of weird to me because it doesn't seem like Esau had no, quote, sexual immoral thought in his mind. All he knew that was he was hungry and he wanted something to eat. And so that's, he was willing to give up everything until it came when his father gave the blessing to his brother. So.
Okay.
I don't see how that fits.
Yeah, I have talked about this passage on a number of different occasions, and I've just said Esau was short-sighted.
I think the verse that I have here, lest there be any fornicator or profane person as Esau, and I think the profane ties better with Esau because Esau profaned his inheritance. He basically gave it no worth, no godly worth, and that's where I think the tie comes between the two of them.
Okay, so you would take Esau and link him with being, in the New International, godless.
Yes, profane, yeah.
Okay, which makes some sense.
Oh, mine reads as immoral. It has no, I mean, it has the word immoral, but it doesn't have sexually immoral in front of it. It just says that there be no immoral or godless person like Esau. So, I mean, I wouldn't even have considered Esau with sexually immoral, but immoral to me means like maybe, you know, he just robbed people or he, you know, murder. That's not where the word sexually changes the immoral totally different than just the word immoral. So
yeah, immoral is a much broader word.
Right.
That's a good point.
But it had to come from somewhere if they put it. What is that, the new, what version is that?
This version that I'm reading here is the English Standard Version.
Oh, okay.
Well, what I get out of this, I mean, the thing that I think, can you hear me?
Yeah.
Okay. What I get out of this verse, I mean, I get a lot out of it, but the end to me, even though he sought the blessing with tears, he could not change what he had done. And that's where we are when we sin. There are a lot of sins we cannot undo. And thank God that God, we can repent and that God can forgive us, because there are sins that we cannot undo.
No, well, that's true. That's
and
true.
So that's just where that's what I think about in this verse. And it's sad.
Yeah. And there's a lot of value in that. I think about the woman that came to David, and she was talking about how she was deep in debt and couldn't pay it back, and her sons had been sold into debtor's prison to pay it back. And David said to the woman, "We're like water spilt out on the ground that can't be gathered up. Once you sin, there are a lot of ways that you negatively impact people that can't be undone. Can't unring a bell."
That's right.
So, I mean, that would kind of fit with the idea of immoral in the broadest sense of the word.
Yes, and Esau couldn't undo his birthright. I mean, he couldn't get his inheritance back. He
that's
certainly
true.
Couldn't undo that. So
that's true.
Why I say thank God that we can repent and that God will forgive us.
Okay. Good point.
Dean, wasn't his inheritance a gift from God?
I'm sorry, say that again.
Wasn't Esau's inheritance, because he was the firstborn, wasn't that a gift from God? And he disdained it.
You know, I don't know. I don't know if that was mandated by God or if it was a cultural invention.
Well, I understand that it's a cultural thing, but in the womb, God decided who came out first and who came out second, who was holding on to the heel. So, I mean, he was given that in his order of birth for culture, but he profaned what the gift that God gave him, just like you could profane your body.
Yeah, so while the whole birthright notion that the oldest son inherits may be a cultural invention, in this case, in particular, God had a hand in determining birth order. That's interesting. I hadn't thought about it, but interesting point. Okay, well, that finishes verse 17. So next week, Ted will begin at verse 18, and he will talk about the kingdom and this kingdom that cannot be shaken. And of course, that's important to the Jews because the Jewish kingdom had been shaken. But God's kingdom, God's heavenly kingdom, will not be shaken. Now, we'll talk about that some with Ted next week. Is there anything else that we need to mention before we close our meeting this evening? Well, thanks for everyone's input and this is an encouraging word.